Accession number 15562, Reel 2.
Commander Jackson, Reel 2.
Tapped me on the shoulder, and I thought, oh Lord, someone in the back been hurt or something's happened, because there had just been a nasty great crump. And to my amusement and relief, I must admit, I said, "What's the matter, Dapper?" And he said, "Happy birthday, Pat." And I looked at my watch. It was 1 minute past midnight. And we carried on down, and I attacked with my flight commander, Lieutenant, now Admiral Jick, and Garthwaite, who was on the other side. The only other thing I remember was what a beautiful ship the Bismarck looked, although she didn't appear very friendly. Whose one torpedo hit the ship, I've not the slightest idea, and I don't think anybody can claim for themselves the benefit of a hit of this kind. You're always too keen to get the hell out of it. We got back to the fleet, and entirely due to Captain Beauvel in the Victorious shining his searchlight and making signals which took rather longer than usual, Esmond was able to pick up the lights. Otherwise we could probably have missed her. The weather was very, very unpleasant. It was a dark, raining night, and the wind was very strong, but we all landed on, I think, one tail wheel tire burst, and that was about all. The following morning, unfortunately, the cruisers Norfolk, Suffolk had lost the Bismarck. She had evaded their radar, and we were told, or some of us, to carry out a search from the Victorious. And we went off at, I think, about 9 o'clock, 8 o'clock, into this unpleasant weather. And in my case, it was a quite uneventful search, in that we saw nothing apart from breaking seas below and visibility of about, I suppose, a mile, half a mile ahead, with the driving mist and rain. When it came time to find the ship on return, unfortunately the Victorious wasn't anywhere to be found. And we did a search, as always trained, called a square search, and also found nothing. The beacon, as I mentioned earlier, didn't bring us any return, because we weren't tuned to Victorious's beacon. And it came to watching the petrol in the tank getting less and less, and I was beginning to wonder what the next world was going to be like, because the sea looked very uninviting, when my good friend in the back, Dapper Beddle, tapped me again on the shoulder, and pointing down, I looked over the side, and there, outlined by breaking water, was a ship's, or a lifeboat, but it was obviously full of water. But it didn't take me more than a moment to realize that that was the only thing I was going to be able to survive in, and so, dropping a smoke float to find the direction and strength of the wind, landed the aircraft in the sea, upwind of the was then all I could see was breaking water, but realized as it was there was the lifeboat. We got into our rubber dinghy, which we had to manhandle out of the upper wing, and drifted down onto this rather wet looking boat. Coming alongside it, it was full of water, and the only thing we had to bail with were our flying boots, which we used as scoops, and eventually one person got into the boat, and eventually the three of us, and we were all promptly rather seasick, I think it was possibly due to the strain of the last hour or two. We had been in the air, I suppose, the best part of 5.5 hours then, and that was pretty well over the limits. The boat, once we had bailed it out, was an ordinary ship's lifeboat. It had a nasty-looking great hulk of canvas in the middle, which could have covered bodies. It also had a mast and sweeps. It had a tin of Craveney tobacco, no, cigarettes, which were very waterlogged. It also, as we discovered later, it had a beaker of water, and there were hard ship's biscuits in a locker in the middle, in mid-thwart. The sail was in a kit bag. It was a dipping lugsail, free-footed. It was also an axe which I used to cut down one of the sweeps to make a gaff, which I couldn't find and wasn't in the boat. But in any case, it gave us something to do, and it was very pleasant to get underway eventually with this dipping lugsail, because it eased the motion of the boat and also gave us a purpose. Where were we to go was the next query, because as far as I could reckon, we were about halfway across the Atlantic Ocean. The nearest place was Greenland, but Greenland is a very inhospitable country, and as far as I remembered from school days, it came to a point and the only place that was habitable was on the west coast. Otherwise, you had a barren east coast with rocks. In any case, the wind at that time was blowing quite strongly, if I remember, from the west. And far off geography lessons at school gave me to understand that the westerly wind was rather more often the case in the North Atlantic. And so we set sail running before it with the hope we might eventually find Scotland or the Shetlands or somewhere. However, that night it blew from the complete opposite direction, so we then set about thinking that the North American coast was rather bigger and better to hit, although we didn't quite realise that as far north as we were, our chances were that we'd hit Labrador, which was even more inhospitable, perhaps, than Greenland. However, we optimistically went west, and my birthday, as I say, was spent in this boat. And on the 26th, we started going west. Then, we passed through a lot of obviously a convoy that had been attacked by U-boats, because there were all sorts of bits of timber, grating covers, and I remember seeing a piece of meat floating by. Just then we also saw what we took to be the periscope of a U-boat. So down sail, and we got down under the gunwales, hoping it wouldn't see us. But as it got closer, it turned out to be one table leg of a broken table bobbing past. And so, with relief, we went on. And I think it was that night that it blew up again very, very hard, and we were swamped. And in bailing out again, we bailed some of our navigation equipment over the side. We had, in fact, taken water, or rather we hadn't taken water. I had taken the various pistol and various cartridges from the front cockpit, and my observer had taken the navigational equipment from the back. The gunner, our gunner, had been told to take our water bottles, which would have helped us, but he, in the panic, had left them behind. Through the night, it was very unpleasant because the sea was extremely rough, and you'd be down in the troughs in the peace and quiet, and then you'd go riding up on top of a crest where the waves are breaking, and all hell would be let loose, and then you go down again on switchback. We made sea anchors out of the floorboards and rope, but unfortunately they parted, and after two anyway. But we carried on sailing, and the extraordinary thing was that in the middle of the Atlantic, and I don't know which day it was, but we'd been there for 4 or 5 days, when we suddenly saw another sail. And closing it, we found it to be a completely black sail with a black boat underneath, and about 4 or 5, or maybe 8, very white faces all gazing towards us. And as I closed it, the figure in the stern shouted across, and I think he was a Norwegian or a Scandinavian, and asked where we were going. I said, well, we're aiming to go to the American continent. And he told me, it is very cold in Labrador, you will die. And I said, well, it's not very warm over here, is it? But where are you going? And he said, I'm aiming for Greenland. And I said, how long have you been looking? And he said, 2 weeks. I have many dead men in the bottom of the boat. Will you come with me? And I had to make the decision that our chances in a lighter boat, which was sailing faster, would be better on our own. So I passed some dog biscuits and this very wet tin of Craven A cigarettes across, and said we would go on our way. It was astounding to see these poor devils, who obviously were very near to death even then, stuff the wet cigarettes into their mouths, which I would have thought would have only added to their problems. Anyway, we left them and we went on our way.
Did they say they had no food?
They had no food or water. The only stuff they had was the stuff that I passed over, which was difficult to do because it was a case of not getting too close. Well, I didn't want them to grab the boat and take over. I'm sure they were very weak at that time. In any case, we weren't too strong ourselves because we'd been in the boat for 4 or 5 days. Eventually, what decided me against Greenland was America. My air gunner, who had foolishly not taken off his flying boots after bailing out and put them back on again and kept them wet and his feet in a wet compress, came back to me and said he was in awful agony with his legs. And I must admit, feeling them, his legs felt like sacks of broken ice. So I used to massage them, but they went black, and I can imagine they were getting gangrenous. And visualized myself trying to operate with a rusty knife on his feet. And we decided then that we had to do something. The land was still probably Greenland, which was nearer. So we went north with an idea of going north for a few more days and then turning to the west, because I thought we were still to the east of the point.
Could you easily steer the ship?
Oh, yes. At that time, I had the boat's rudder. But owing to the gales and the fact that when we had a sea anchor, the rudder was still shipped and used to take a lot of the battering of the waves, the pintles were showing signs of wear, and eventually did, in fact, we lost the rudder and had to use a steering oar, but that came a little bit later. However, going north, we found that with the dawn, or when it's daybreak, we used to find birds coming out, and I realized that very few birds stay at sea at night, and used to notice where they came from, and I steered in that direction. And it was in a full gale of sleet, snow, and unpleasantness, with badly worn sails, on the June the 4th, I think it was. June 4th. We were running actually under the jib alone because the mainsail was torn, and we saw ahead a faint outline of a ship on the crest of a wave, and then we'd lose it as we went into the trough, and we came up again and there it was. And that's when the various lights I'd taken out of the aeroplane came into full play, but the ship didn't seem to notice any of them and steamed merrily along with the smoke streaming from behind her. She had a funny flag painted on the side, which I didn't recognize. But eventually the last, I think it was the very last of the various cartridges, was a smoke puff, and it went off with a rather large pumph. And then we heard this lovely sound of the ship's siren, and she steered towards us, and after that it was just a case of these husky Icelanders, as they turned out to be, leaping into the boat and helping us out, and their hospitality for the next week, as she steamed against this gale, was tremendous. They, when we proved we were actually British and not Germans, as they thought, they couldn't have been more hospitable than Captain Gislason of the SS Lagerfoss, which was plying between Halifax and Reykjavik with wheat. Was an absolute charmer. My air gunner and my observer both went into sick bay with leg trouble. Somehow I seemed to have been perfectly all right and remained so until I got back to England some 2 weeks later, when I found I got pins and needles and the blood circulation was not too good. The air gunner, in fact, lost his toes from frostbite, and Dapper Bedell stayed in Reykjavik Hospital for about a week.
What were the names of your two companions?
Lieutenant Bedell, B-E-R-R-I-L-L, called Dapper, and leading airman Sparks, who was a new man in my crew. As I said earlier, I had lost my old air gunner to the Ark Royal some weeks before. Yes, Errol and Sparks, leading airman Sparks.
So how long had you been in the boat?
It was 9.5 days altogether. We were picked up, I think it was the 3rd or 4th of June, whatever 9.5 days is after the 25th of May. I came back then and had a week's leave, I think, before joining another squadron, which was a deck landing training squadron.
Had you at any stage given up hope?
No, because I don't wish to get into religion as such, but both Beryl and myself were Roman Catholic, and Dapper always said we'll be rescued on the ninth day, because he had been saying a novena, which is something we Catholics keep up our sleeve as a last resort. And true enough, it was the ninth day. I myself, watching the petrol of my aircraft slowly draining out, had said three Hail Marys, and sure enough, as a result of that, the lifeboat was given to us. So let that be a enough said about our religious aspect, but the good Lord and our fate seem to be in our favour.
Had you totally run out of food and drink by the time you were rescued?
Well, no, we rationed ourselves, of course, immediately. I might mention that we also, in a locker, was a bottle of Napoleon brandy, which, when we first landed or got into the boat, we took a sip, but we had fairly empty tummies, only having had time for breakfast, and we found it made us even more sick, possibly, and it was very strong stuff for our stomachs at that time, and we kept that purely for medicinal purposes, which never really turned up again. The water we rationed ourselves to, because A, the air gunner forgot to bring our own billy can of water, and the biscuits, in fact, are quite inedible unless you soak them in water, so your water ration soaked the biscuits, because we all suffered from the cold, and it gave us our teeth became very tender and gums. The Irving jacket that we, or jackets that we wore, of course, was saturated with seawater, but proved very efficient to keep the upper part of your body quite warm. Our feet, we took our flying boots off, that is, Beryl and myself, and we had to scurry about the boat, and of course kept the circulation in the feet going purely by bumping against things, and also we used to sit, and whoever was on the helm used to put his feet inside the Irving jacket of the other chap, so that they kept moderately warm. It was cold, and we didn't suffer from hunger or thirst, really, as you would do in a warmer climate. But how long that would have gone on, I've no idea. The biscuits were still there, and we had a little water left, and one bottle of brandy. But you can't live on that.
Would you have survived if you hadn't run into the Icelandic
ship? I doubt it. I doubt it, because I must admit that when we first saw that, Dapper was on the steering oar, and I was sitting on the midship thwarts, just looking at this very cruel sea with driving snow and sleet, and thinking, well, there's not much else you can do. As it turned out, we were only 15 miles off Greenland when we were picked up, and she had the Lagerfoss had actually sighted the mountains before she'd gone into these snowstorms that day, that morning.
What would have happened to you if you had hit the coast of Greenland? Would you, craft have survived?
No, not if we'd hit the coast, but if we'd seen it in good time, obviously it'd be a north-south direction, and I might have gone down to around the south to try and get round the point. But then again, you would have to find the right field to go up to get to, I think their capital is called Godhaven or somewhere. It was all by guess and by God. It was, no, I don't think we would have survived. I think we would probably have been swamped, quite frankly. It was that sort of weather. And it wouldn't last very long in the cold water.
Did you have hallucinations whilst you were in the boat?
Yes, I did, in fact. Didn't get much sleep. Without trying to shoot a line, I was older than the other two and had done a lot of sailing down here on the south where I now live, and so getting the sail up and sailing the boat was quite like old times. But it did mean that until Dapper became capable, I mean, I say that only keeping the sails filled and giving direction. Otherwise, he was the most capable fellow anyway. One had to stay awake, and as a result of not getting any sleep, I did hallucinate one night. I dreamt that we were sailing round the moon and that the British consul came out and asked me if I'd like a hot bath. And I could imagine nothing I'd like better. So I started to walk ashore across great lily pads which were floating all round the boat towards the moon. But fortunately, old Dapper realised what was happening and pulled me back on board. I had one leg over the side, I think. So, yes, I did have hallucinations. I don't like to think it was the tot of brandy I'd had, because that had been some days before.
Can I go back to the attack on the Bismarck? At what kind of speed did you go into the attack?
Well, as we train the lads to, the only way you could get speed in a swordfish was to dive down from altitude. So we did dive down, I suppose, from 2,000 or so feet, or 1,500, whatever the cloud base at that particular moment was. And you went in, you dropped your torpedo at about 30 feet. And your speed, I think, had to be something in the, if I remember correctly, it's a long time ago now, but something in the region of about 60 or 70 knots. It depended upon your correct angle of approach that your torpedo had to hit the water so that it wouldn't porpoise. And I seem to remember that we were going in fairly flat in Vic formation, as I said earlier, with Jick just ahead and myself on the port side and Garthwaite on the right. We all dropped. Of course, the Bismarck was zigzagging quite hard, and one just had to aim ahead of her and hope that you get it. Torpedo would make contact, but the speed went in about 60 or 70 knots, rather slow in facing a ship of that kind.
Do you think any of its gunfire came near you?
Oh, well, yes, it was all around us, but I think the only person hit was Esmond, who got a bit of shrapnel through his propeller boss. On the way out, Jick, I think, had one underneath, stranded in the sea underneath, which took the bottom out of his rear cockpit, or so I read. And his air gunner, who I think was Bunce, wasn't it?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think so, we could find out. But he had to sort of sit there with a cold draft blowing up his bottom all the way back to Victoria's. Of course, the crew of the Bismarck, especially their anti-aircraft gunners, were handicapped by A, the rough seas, and also the zigzag the ship was making. But there was a lot of fire which one had to go through, but apart from the approach when the heavier anti-aircraft fire was going off around you, and German flak was always black, and it's unpleasant in an open cockpit like the Swordfish. You can smell it as well as see it. And but they were always aiming ahead. They couldn't believe, of course, that we were going so slowly. And we were going slowly because the wind was quite strong. And there was, of course, I didn't mention, but if you read the history of it, there was an American Coast Guard vessel which we crossed over. They must have been very frightened. But I remember thinking then that if I was hit, that was a place to go, because we could have been picked up on if anything had happened to the aeroplane, or to us indeed. She was only about 7 miles from the Bismarck. In fact, it was halfway between the Prince of Wales and the Bismarck, because the Prince of Wales told us the Bismarck was 15 miles on her starboard bow, I think.